Welcome back to a very, very special edition of Live from West End. Today we have Mr. Skip Bayless, a former recipient of the Grantland Rice Scholarship and Vanderbilt Hustler sports editor who graduated cum laude in 1974, an extensive journalism career spanning from the Miami Herald, Los Angeles Times, Dallas Morning News, and the Chicago Tribune. He's also written several books about his own Dallas Cowboys. He's best known for his commentary on ESPN and Fox Sports, and he currently is the host of Undisputed on Fox Sports 1 and the Skip Bayless Show. Mr. Bayless, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on today.
It's always a pleasure to reconnect with Nashville. I miss Nashville. I miss being around you guys there. I don't get back that much, but at least I can feel from LA where I am right now some sort of reconnection with you guys.
Absolutely. Can you talk about what it was like being sports editor? Any special moments that you can remember and you hold true to your heart?
That's a great question. It was always hard for my friends at other schools to understand that I won a scholarship for sports writing at a school with no journalism school.
Right.
And so, as you guys know, all the time that you dedicate to the Hustler or to this podcast, it's all extracurricular. You know, like you don't get any class credit for this unless something's changed. I don't think you do, right? Do you get any,
no.
any class credits you get? For?
No.
No, okay. So I just remember a lot of really late nights writing, editing, throwing newspapers together and getting no sleep because it wasn't for class. It was for me, you know, it was for my professional growth. And the best times were the late nights when I'm writing on deadline. And the great times I had in my time with the great John Bloom was the year after me. And he was such a gifted creator, creative writing. And we would vibe off each other and we would try things that were outrageously out of bounds, probably not in opinion, but just in form and style and substance. And we would try things that if we had been at a journalism school, there's no way we would have had the license or the liberty to try what we used to try. And it really jump-started me as a writer to be able to experiment, occasionally hit on one. But I just remember various pieces. I can remember headlines we wrote off the pieces. My special times were the either columns or the features that I wrote. And I can remember them all like they were yesterday, none of which would mean anything to you guys or you would care about. But back in the day, it's just so special to write about. Remember, Vanderbilt baseball obviously is a national power now, but back in my day, it was a long time ago, but my 4 years at Vanderbilt, and this is forever ago, way before you were even born, 1970 to 74, we won the SEC in baseball all 4 years. We won the SEC in basketball my senior year, which is beyond the realm of possibility to you guys right now. You can't even conceive of that.
But we'll get to that.
So my joy came from being able to write about champions at Dormat Vanderbilt. In fact, my football team, my senior year, was very good and pulled off an upset of nationally ranked Georgia. They were a tough villain. We beat them 17-14 with Steve Sloan as the head coach. So it was a glorious time for me to be sort of feeling my creative oats while I was inspired to write about Smokey Schmidto's Vanderbilt Commodore baseball team and our SEC champion basketball team and obviously our up and coming football team. And you guys you've had the baseball obviously, but you haven't had the others. So I was blessed. I was there at a really great sports time.
For sure, Mr. Bayless, thank you so much for coming on. This is such a great honor for us. And I was just wondering how kind of your work at The Hustler for your 4 years here kind of prepared you for a career in sports journalism. Obviously, you've worked at some incredible places like the LA Times, ESPN, Fox Sports. So how did your time at The Hustler prepare you for that?
Again, I was forced to write and write and write my guts out because that's what we did. And I think our staffs were much smaller than your staff now. There weren't that many kids interested or involved. And we were sort of like this little, you know, underground newspaper against creating havoc for people. And we sort of prided ourselves on that. And again, I was so pieces that I wrote that I used them upon graduation as part of my package to present to newspapers to sell myself to the newspaper. So I had carte blanche, man. I could write about whatever I wanted to write about at great. We would get magazine length pieces in The Hustler. And so it really rocket launched my career because people could read, you know, sports editors at the first one was the Miami Herald, which led to my going to the LA Times 3 years later. Well, they saw my, as we called them in those days, clips, because we didn't have the internet, but my clips from Vanderbilt were bombshell because I had the leeway and the space to write magazine type pieces that would be very impressive to a sports editor because kids just didn't have that sort of cachet yet at other school papers. So it also, once I, like, again, I'm from originally Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. So my junior summer, I interned at my hometown paper. It's called the Daily Oklahoman, and it was the most fun I ever had, but they just let me do everything. But whatever I needed to learn about journalism that I would have learned in J school, I learned in my summer at the Daily Oklahoman because I actually participated in it. And so the point is that it really helped me. Where a lot of kids that I came up with in newspapers, they had to unlearn a lot of things that they learned in journalism school that didn't apply to the real world. So the Hustler was great just on my creative front. And then my one summer as intern, I learned all the nuts and bolts of how to do the business. So it was just, I look back on the Hustler as I ever got. I was so blessed to be able to write for the Hustler for my all 4 years.
You often talk about how being a sports journalist is something you were meant to do. Everyone on this earth has a purpose and a duty. Can you talk about when you realized that realization and that epiphany and when you just ran with it?
I didn't, but a journalism teacher did. And I'll just tell you a very quick story. Again, I was the oldest in a family with two parents who didn't even graduate from high school. So nobody read, nobody wrote. I'd never written any more than my name. And I was also blessed my sophomore year of high school that I was in an advanced English course that was taught by the journalism teacher. She taught one class a day outside of journalism, just to see if she could find kids who could write for the school paper. And it was called The Shield at my high school because we were the Knights, so it was The Shield. But the point was, my first day of class with her, my sophomore year of school, she assigned us a one-page book report. And her point to us was, I just want to see if you can write. So she said, don't dwell on it, just want to see if you have any writing talent or not. And we're like, oh, wow, we're kind of on the hot seat first day of school. She was tough. Her name was Liz Dad. She's very intimidating, had giant black hair, wore bright red lipstick, and she was just scary. And so I chose a sports book because that's all I did was play sports. And I didn't love it. I thought it felt like it had been written overnight, and I read it in one night. And so I just critiqued it. I wrote a review, a pretty scathing review of this. It was a biography of an old New York Giant quarterback named Y.A. Tittle, way before your time, but turned it in. Friday came around, and when class was dismissed, she said, Skip Bayless, I need to see you at my desk. And my friends look sideways at me like, what did you do? Because she was scary. So I go up to the desk coming into journalism. And I said, I'm sorry, I have no interest in journalism. And she said, you don't have to have any interest in journalism. You're going to write 2 columns a week. She said, you will write 2 sports columns a week for my paper. And I said, I don't want to write headlines or do all that. They had like folding parties in journalism for this. You had to fold the papers that we distributed. And she said, you don't have to do any of that. So she launched me. And I was born to do this, but I wouldn't be here if she hadn't forced me into journalism my sophomore year. And then the rest was history.
Wow, that's an amazing story. You talked about YA Tittle. So this is the great transition of the quarterback class in the 2024 NFL draft. Can you speak about what you see in this class and the projected first-round quarterbacks? Does it remind you at all with the 2012 class, 2004 class, or 1983 class?
Well, I can't go that far just yet. It is deep in quarterbacks, and I do think the sort of fifth and sixth quarterbacks on the list have a chance to be very good in the league. Bo Nix, Mike Jr. I'm a Caleb Williams fan. I grew up a University of Oklahoma fan, so I got to see him up close and personal as a true freshman thrown into the fire for my Oklahoma Sooners against the Texas Longhorns in our game of the year every year. And he was extraordinary. He took the game over, and he is a very special playmaker. And it will translate to the next level. He has great elusivity, maybe not like Johnny Manziel had, but in the ballpark. And he has a much bigger arm than Johnny ever dreamed of having. And he has it quality to me. He came to Hollywood with Lincoln Riley, obviously, and won the Heisman. And I know a lot of people think he's a little too full of himself. I think that's a good thing. And I just think even if he has to brave the Chicago winters, if it comes down to that, and I'm not totally convinced that's where he's heading, but he's big time to me. He's going to be somebody's game changer, life changer. So I do believe in him. And I do believe in Jaden Daniels as not quite on his level, but still a very good starting quarterback. And the more I think and delve into J.J. McCarthy, I think he's a keeper for somebody because he did win a national championship for Michigan, and he made all the throws he was asked to make, which weren't that many, but he did make them on the biggest stages under the biggest pressure. I'm not sure about Drake May. I'm starting to call him Drake Maybe. I just watched television. I watched him about 5 times, and I never was knocked off my couch while I was watching him. I didn't see the poise or the command or the accuracy that I wanted to consistently see. So he's the one that I would say could be a swing and miss. I'm not sure I can go to your great classes, especially 1983. It was extraordinary. I just think Caleb's going to be a big star. That's what I know about this class, is that he's one in this class.
That's great. Thank you, Mr. Bayless. You obviously have great insight into the NFL. And now to kind of transfer to college athletics maybe a little bit. Obviously, there's the state of NIL right now and the transfer portal for college athletics. How can a school like Vanderbilt, which maybe doesn't have the resources like NIL-wise as a Georgia or an Alabama, who maybe can't get senior transfers because, you know, academic requirements would allow you, you have to take 60 hours at Vanderbilt. How can Vanderbilt compete in the SEC, a really competitive conference, with these other big schools who have huge NIL funds?
You're asking the age-old question that we asked in 1974 when I was there and we beat Georgia, and then we'd look and say, and obviously it's great, especially for the other sports, that we stay in the SEC, but it's, as you just suggest with a great question, it's virtually impossible to compete with an ever-expanding SEC that now will include my Oklahoma Sooners and Texas Longhorns, and it's only going to get rougher. So I campaigned for years for college kids to get paid to play football and basketball and baseball, whatever they played. For that matter, the women should get paid at the highest levels when they are Caitlin Clark. So the one thing that you guys would know better than I is that when it comes to funding the NIL, that I have a lot of friends from my era at Vanderbilt, and they all have a lot of money and they're very interested in sports. So this is out of my lane and over my head, but it just seems like at your fingertips would be a lot of money that could be dedicated to NIL. If you have academic requirements that supersede that funding, then I can't help you. You know, I can't beat that, because I don't want Vanderbilt to become the University of Oklahoma, which is a great party school. It's a good school, has a good law school, but it's easy to get athletes in and out of University of Oklahoma, and I'm not even sure they go to class. I have no idea. But the point is, it feels like the age-old question and issue has been the academic requirements. And back in my day, I don't even know what the relationship is with Peabody, but we used to, this is back in the 70s, we started a relationship with Peabody so that we could get the jocks, as we said, to walk across the street and actually be able to get through classes at Peabody. I don't know what's happened at now, but that's back in my day, that was an issue. And that was a solution to the issue. So Vanderbilt's never going to have enough depth of talent to compete with Alabama or Oklahoma or Texas, whoever it's going to be, because you just don't, you can't get enough oriented star athletes to fill out a depth of a college football championship roster. That's pie in the sky, and we have to accept who we are, and we have to focus more on just being competitive in football. And then I think we've lost our way in basketball. We have a new coach, obviously. We should be able to compete in basketball. I saw my team in 74 win the SEC. And obviously in baseball, we are a truly bona fide national power. And I'm very proud of that, because that was doable, but it took the right, which you have, to make that continue to happen. And it does. It's sustaining itself. We're not going to be national champions every year, but we're going to be really good a factor. So fire away.
Before we transition into your personal life, just another question about you as a sports writer, going to games for decades. What is one memory, one sporting event that you hold closest to your heart, whether it be in Miami or in Dallas or another city? And just talk about what that game meant for you and really helped you catapult your career.
Hey, quickly, I'll give you two. I am a lifelong diehard Dallas Cowboy. Did have the amazing opportunity to go back to Dallas from LA to be the lead columnist for the Dallas Morning News and then the Dallas Times through the Tom Landry rise and fall. And it's funny, but the greatest game I ever experienced was a game they lost. And it was a turning point of the Landry dynasty and the launch of the Bill Walsh, Joe Montana dynasty. And it was at Candlestick Park in early 1982, and it became known as the catch game. Montana to Dwight Clark late in the game for the game-winning score. And the Cowboys got the ball back, but they didn't have Roger Staubach at quarterback anymore. They had his replacement, Danny White, his understudy for many years. And Danny wasn't Roger, and Danny got strip-sacked and fumbled the ball and when we had a chance to get back. I wasn't saying we at that time. I'm now just like an out-of-the-closet Cowboy fan. But I wrote very beloved by Cowboy Nation. But that was a momentous moment. That was the launch of one dynasty and the beginning of the end of the Cowboy dynasty. And that stadium shook literally seismically when Dwight Clark went up into the fog and came down with that pass over a rookie Cowboy, Everson Walls. And my other greatest moment came in a sport that you guys might love that I never knew because I didn't grow up with it, but it was the sport of hockey. I was at the Winter Olympics in 1980 at Lake Placid up in New York, and we got to the second and final Friday of the fortnight, and I didn't have anything. I knew there was this hockey game that night at Lake Placid Arena, featuring our gutty little American team against the big bad Russians. And I asked our press liaison, do you have any tickets left for that game? And he said, I got a bunch. What do you want? I said, I just need whatever the best one is. And he said, here, take this one. And it was like front row, press row. Nobody wanted to go because they had played an exhibition game at Madison Square Garden the month before. And I think the score was 10-1 Soviets over Americans. So I go to a sport I don't know, hockey, and I sat next to a guy who became a very good friend of mine named Larry Feltzer, who's a legendary columnist at the Buffalo News, a hockey writer, first and foremost. And he's explaining the rules of hockey as I watch the greatest upset in the history of sports unfold before my very eyes, a game that was tape delayed for the rest of America hours later. And I got to write about a hockey game, the first time I'd ever written about hockey, but it was the game that transcended the sport of hockey. The Russians, that was the semifinal. And then Sunday, of course, they were able to beat Finland for the gold medal. So I lucked into the greatest upset in the history of the world.
That's an unbelievable story. That sounds crazy. I can't imagine being there in person for that. So that's an amazing story. The viewers are going to love that. That's going to be great. As we kind of transition to maybe more of your personal life outside of sports, perhaps, what do you like to do when you aren't recording your show, Undisputed, and talking about sports?
I try to play golf. Hardest game in the world, and it's my first love and my greatest hate, and it bedevils me on a weekly basis. I try to go out after Tuesday and Thursday shows, and a member at Brentwood Country Club here in Los Angeles on the west side of LA. Occasionally when I get lucky, when nobody's out there, I get in 18 on a Tuesday or Thursday, but it haunts me and delights me on levels I can't even fathom and I can't explain to you, but that's my passion. And that's my, I still play some basketball when I can find somebody to play with and against. I shoot baskets here and there. I like to go escape and just shoot. Those are my two escape passions. I blow off steam that way.
That's great. Well, Andrew and I are definitely big golfers too, so you can relate to the frustrating nature of golf. It can be an unbelievably frustrating game. You can go from hitting your best shot of your life to the worst. So it's crazy.
That is correct. And just when you think you have it, you don't have it.
Exactly.
It's all about between the ears.
Between the ears. Totally agree.
Final question for you. Everyone knows your infamous debate of LeBron versus MJ. The current Lakers, if they make a plan, do you see them even getting a game against Denver? And also, can you talk about your relationship with Michael Jordan, if there is a strong relationship there?
I had a great relationship with Michael when I was the columnist at the Chicago Tribune, and I just happened to be there, blessed again, for the greatest single season I ever watched, which was the Last Dance season in 1998 in Chicago, and I got to know Michael well. He can be difficult to deal with, but he always liked and respected me, and I will forever be indebted to him for that with him post-career. But now back to today's Lakers. Speaking of LeBron, it's so weird. These are shaping up as the greatest single conference of playoffs I've ever encountered. We're the Western Conference playoffs because the Lakers are looking like they're going to be the 10 seed. So they're the one of the play-in with potential to win the conference. And because Anthony Davis has been so dominant all year long, he's dealing with an eye injury, and I don't know the extent. I think it developed into a concussion. But if he's right, they have a chance to beat Denver. And I would love to see a rematch in the conference finals with Denver, because all four games last year, LeBron disappeared in all four fourth quarters, and he shot a combined 7 of 23 through those four. It was 1 of 10 from three, but they had chances. His apologist told me, well, he ran out of gas. Well, once again, this year, LeBron has played the fourth most minutes in the entire NBA. So maybe your excuse, just in case he fails against Denver again, he could say, I just ran out of gas. And I'm thinking, well, you played all those minutes and you only got the 10th seed out of it. At least you could be the first seed, but he wasn't the first seed. He's the 10th seed. They did win the in-season tournament and they flexed their muscles and showed you this is what we can do. But I believe they're good enough to win the West. I like their team. I like their depth. I like everything about it. I like the coach. A lot of Laker fans down on the coach, but I think he's very good. So my point to you is I picked the Lakers before the season started to win the West, and I'm going to stick with it, even though their mountain to climb is brutal because they're going to have to climb through maybe Sacramento and then Golden State, and then who knows how that'll play out from that point forward. They could get Denver sooner than later. They could get them in the first round, obviously, if they even make it to the first round. But I've liked the Lakers all year. I've loved the way LeBron has played. He's 1% from three. He fixed his three-point shot. As he said once upon a time after he won his first championship, it's about damn time. Well, it's about damn time he could shoot threes. So in year 21, he finally figured out how to shoot throws. There's a whole other issue that has not been solved. But I'm going to stick with them. I picked them before the year, and yet, man, they are looking way up at Denver right now. And yet, if LeBron pulled this off from the 10 seed, then they would, his apologists would begin to make his GOAT case again, which is over. He's lost that. It's that's in the past. He is nothing but the phony GOAT. So
a lot of exciting stuff. It's really such an honor to be speaking to such a Vanderbilt legend, probably our most prized alumni along with Al Gore. And we are just so grateful to have you. And we really look forward to keeping a strong connection with you, Mr. Bayless, and the Vanderbilt Hustler.
Thank you so much for coming on, Mr. Bayless.